It's time for security now. Steve Gibson is here to explain all, to show us why access control lists may not always work as you expect. The story behind the failure of the Google Titan security key and a patch for Windows XP. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 715, recorded Tuesday, May 21st, 2019. CPU.fail. Security Now is brought to you by Thinkst Canary. Detect attackers on your network with honeypots that can be deployed in minutes. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. And by WordPress. Turn your dreams into reality and launch your website at wordpress.com. Get 15% off any new plan at wordpress.com/securitynow. And by Pulseway, the ridiculously cool IT management software that lets you remotely manage and control IT systems from any device. It's enabling busy admins to fix issues on the go and be more productive. Try it free for 14 days at pulseway.com/twit. It's time for Security Now with Mr. Steve Gibson, the star of the show, the king of internet security and privacy. There's no one better able. Well, I kind of crowned you myself, but
thank you very much.
At least I didn't put you on the iron throne.
I was just going to say we didn't have any chance to talk about the Game of Thrones finale, and we don't want to do any spoilers for those who
we can't.
No, we can't say anything about.
But you could tell me if you liked it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of sorry it ended. Like,
I was just so sad.
Yeah, I could have kept watching them run around in circles for like another 15 years.
I do think eventually people want to move on. Although, and I don't think it's a spoiler to say so, the way it ended left lots of room for sequels. And in fact, I had heard that there will be. HBO is making some spinoffs and so forth. You could do both.
No kidding.
Prequels. But, well, good. I'm not going to say anything about who or anything, but there were people. They could reuse
a lot of those costumes.
Oh,
they
man.
Got lots of spears. They got lots of shields. They got all kinds of stuff.
Regardless of how you feel about the storytelling, no spoiler to say a lot of people on the internet. There's even a 1 million signature petition HBO has to reshoot the whole entire thing. The last season they blew it. I disagree with that, but I found it quite enjoyable. But I, like you, I was mostly sad that it was over. Somebody said, and I think this might be true, this may be one of the last times, if not the last time, the whole vast swath of people sits down on a Sunday night to watch a show because, of fragmentation. There are going to be so many different, there are more and more places to watch stuff. And B, a lot of these places dump the whole series, you know, all at once.
In binge mode.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so I wonder if there'll be an event like this again in our history. I don't know.
Well, the good news is Lori is someone like me who is able to watch something that's really good again. I've watched Breaking Bad now all the way through twice.
We're doing that. It's such a good show.
She fell in love with it.
Yeah.
And so like we're just like waiting for it to be long enough to watch it again. And so I'm so happy that I'm with someone that the woman I married years ago absolutely wouldn't even consider it. She says, well – we know what happens. I said, but it's art. It's artwork. It's a process. No. That's like, okay, fine.
No, anyway, I'm with you. So, and Lisa and I, in fact, are watching Breaking Bad again. And what a great show. That was so well done.
And it's, you know, it's the humor that was so much a part of it.
Yeah.
They had fun.
It was a great show. And the plotting and the acting and everything.
No humor this week.
No
humor for you. Today's title is CPU.fail, which actually is the website that was created to contain rather four different new problems, of which Zombie Load was but one.
Oy.
So, yeah. And
This is a gift that just keeps on giving. It's another one of those speculation errors, right?
Yes. Well, it's worse than that. Remember that of the two, we had Meltdown, the Meltdown and then the Spectre problems. Right. Meltdown was easier to do and was a bigger problem. Spectre was always sort of more itself speculative. And less obviously a big problem. Well, this is the logical extension of Meltdown into much bigger problems. I mean, basically, I'm reminded that I'm stepping on my own dialogue from the end of this podcast. But you know, Bruce Schneier gave us what I often quote him saying. Attacks never get weaker, they only get stronger. The guys who did Meltdown basically never stopped working on this, and they made them practical. They reduced this to, yes, we can actually obtain a 128-bit AES key and they demonstrate it from another process running on a shared hosting environment. The good news is, first of all, you know, once again, the industry is taking it seriously. And also, this only really impacts, as has always been the case, environments where you have inherently untrusted code sharing the same physical chassis, which is not the typical listener. You know, it's not the end user mode. It's the cloud environment, and that's where the problem really is. So this has all been good for locking that down. But we have a lot of other fun stuff to talk about. We will end up talking about that in more detail. Also, we now have some visibility into last Tuesday's patches from Microsoft, Adobe and Apple. Microsoft and Adobe were biggies. Apple, you know, we never really get that much out of Apple. We know that they did respond to the microcode problem with the patches, and we have a little bit of something from them. We also take a look at a big new problem that has just come to light from Cisco. So that's big enough that it's got stock analysts taking notice and saying, okay, like maybe this is going to have a financial impact on them.
Yikes.
We check in on the ongoing troubles with the cryptocurrency market that we haven't dipped into recently. Matthew Green kind of lost it on Twitter over his reactions to Google's Titan Bluetooth dongle screw-up.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it's really fun. So we're going to follow his Twitter stream a little bit. Also, we deal with yet another monthly problem that Microsoft just seems to be having now every month with their Windows 10 updates. We'll touch on a bit of miscellany and then wrap up by talking about what is now being called microarchitectural data sampling vulnerabilities, which is the umbrella under which all of these problems can sort of be aggregated. Microarchitectural data sampling vulnerabilities, or as I also called it later on, speeding up is hard to do.
All right.
So, and of course, we have...
The picture for after the ad. What about?
Yes, we're going to do that after the ad.
Okay.
Because this is just... It's just, good. It's just too funny.
It illustrates the issue with access control.
Yes, and you have to ask yourself, what were they trying to accomplish, really? I mean, it's just like, okay, really? Okay, who was in charge here?
Okay. Our show, we'll talk about that and show you that if you're watching the video, but we can describe it if you're not as well in just a bit. But first, a word from a great sponsor. And I wonder often when we hear about these long breaches, these, what do they call it, APTs, advanced persistent threats, where bad guys get into your network and wander around for months, like Starwood. How long were they in the network before Marriott discovered they were in the reservation system?
Three years. Like, yeah.
Sony Pictures Entertainment, bad guys spearfished them in May, got in May, and hung around until like the end of the year. That can easily be avoided with this little box right here. That is the ultimate honeypot. It's a canary from Thinkst. I think these things are amazing. This is just a little appliance. It's right on it. You can see it's plugged into our network. It took us almost no time to configure. The Thinkst Canary was created by security researchers with decades in the business, and they were people who would go into a company and teach them about security and bad guys. Not just companies, militaries, governments. How they showed them how to break into networks, but also how to keep people from breaking into networks. And you've probably heard us talk about honeypots. I think episode 2, that was the subject. This is essentially a honeypot. It's a device that sits on your network and impersonates something valuable. So in under 4 minutes, you can set this up. Mine right now, this looks like, I shouldn't give this away, but it's not our only canary. So it looks like a NAS server. It looks like Synology. In fact, if you were a bad guy on our network and you found it, there'd be a Synology login, and there'd be Synology services turned on. And I even have some extra little candy on here. You know, data files that say things like salary history or social security numbers. You get the idea. Canaries don't look vulnerable on your network. They look valuable. You can put fake files on them. You can enroll them in Active Directory in case you've got a dumb hacker who's not great at finding stuff. You can make sure that they could find it. It could be a switch. It could be a router. It could be a Linux box. It could be a Windows server. It can be a SCADA device. You can be almost anything. You can turn on a single service, or you can light it up. They call it a Christmas tree with all this. You can have a Windows server with everything wide open. It would fail shields up 100 different ways. It's up to you. And that's the beauty of this. Sprinkle a few canaries on your network. You can also create with your Thinkst canary tokens. Those are files that will phone home whenever they're touched. So anytime somebody tries to log into that Synology NAS, I get a, by the way, I really like how they do this, a kind of a consolidated alert that says, here's the 15 passwords they tried. You're going to see information that will give you information about what they already know. Because if you see an employee's name and a password attempts 4 or 5 times, you know what's going on there. You got a little more information. The tokens can be spread around. We've got PDFs on our network that say things, you know, like employee name, employee histories, all sorts of, you know, juicy stuff. The minute they try to open that, it pings this canary, which pings me. We had, and I know it works because Megan was reviewing a NAS, like a Western Digital Passport or something. It was one of those, you know, kind of pseudo NASs that you plug into the network. And for reasons I'll never really understand, once you attach it to your network, it went out and looked at every other device on your network and started logging it. And all of a sudden, I got an alert, and so did Russell, our IT guy. And so did Thinkst, by the way, because I think they were kind of, because they're a sponsor, kind of helping us out. And it said, well, this device at this address, 10.1.whatever, keeps pinging us. What's going on? We tracked it down to that device, immediately disconnected it from the network. That's how I know how well it works. I got a single clear alert. I could then go to the alert, see all of the sub-alerts that showed what was going on, and it was everything. This is really an affordable solution, by the way. No big, massive upfront cost for servers or anything. You license them annually. And that, by the way, the license includes support and updates. In fact, if your bird breaks during the year, they just send you a new one. It's really an appliance. You can easily try a few. You can scale up to as many as you need. Some small businesses have maybe a couple of canaries. There are big banks. I don't want to get into too much detail, but you can imagine the kind of organizations and companies that might have these. Some of them have hundreds of them spread out all over. And you know what? You'll know what you need. But certainly get a couple. Try it out. They're on all seven continents, which makes me think probably McMurdo has a canary or two. Some of the biggest names in Silicon Valley run them and love them. And I could tell you, if you go to their website, canary.tools/love, they have compiled a bunch of tweets from really well-known security folk talking about the things Canary. And if you don't believe me, or if you're not intrigued by what I've told you, go to canary.tools/love, and that'll put you over the top. That'll convince you. Give you an idea of the pricing. If you want five Canaries at $7,500 a year, you get your own hosted console, you get upgrades, you get support, and of course you get maintenance for that full year. That's actually really affordable. But we're going to make it even better. All you have to do is say TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. Put the network name in the How Did You Hear About Us box, and you'll get 10% off the price forever. 10% off forever. So that's a good deal. We know you're going to love the things Canary, but in case you're saying, well, I don't know. You should know that they have a 2-month money-back guarantee for a full refund. So it totally is risk-free. You got 2 whole months to see if the Canary's doing what it wants. And actually, the best thing with a Canary is to never hear from the Canary. But it's nice every once in a while get a little, you know, there's something on the network. Because then you know, it's there. It's amazing. You'd be crazy with this current security situation, with the spread of worms that can go throughout your network, with the bad guys who use spear phishing attacks to get into your network and then wander around with impunity. You have to have something that detects intrusions and does it in a very clever way. It's the ultimate honeypot, your Canary. Here's how you get 10% off. Go to canary.tools/twit, canary.tools/twit, and enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. That will be signaling them the signal that you heard it on Security Now. And that's good for us, but it'll also get you 10% off. That's good for you forever, for the life of your Canaries. Thank you, Canary. Canary.tools/twit. Use the offer code TWIT. And we know, we've talked about honeypots. We know how well those can work. When I hear about APTs, I really wonder why people aren't doing, you know, these simple, inexpensive things you can do to protect yourself.
Well, and, you know, the wisdom is that you have to have defenses. You have to train your staff and your people, yep, not to do dumb things. Yep. You also have to have an IDS, an intrusion detection system, and that's what this is.
Everybody always says security is a process. It's not a one thing. It's layers. You got to have many layers of security to protect yourself.
Yep. You got to be monitoring. And, in fact, you know, that's the way all of these security firms that we talk about are discovering new things, is they've got public honeypots out on the internet that are catching.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
that's going on.
Yeah.
So that's sort of like at the enterprise security firm level. But individuals care about what's going on in their own network. So, okay. So here we have the picture of the week, Leo.
Yes.
And I love this picture. It's perfect. And we've done something similar. I think I remember one where there was a path, a walking path, and someone had stuck like a locking, like fence door on the path. And you could see the grass was worn on either side, because people said, okay, this path is closed. I'm going to go around the door. I mean, which is like so dumb. But anyway, that's our picture of the week. Is it shows this one lane roadway that separates the outside of, you know, like there's like public cars and things, like a public road, from the inside with this drop-down arm, you know, the motorized arm that blocks the road. but there's nothing to prevent people from saying, okay, I'm in a hurry. I forgot my pass. I'm not supposed to go through here, whatever. And you can clearly see that that it looks like nobody bothers to go through the arm. They just say, forget this, and drive around. Anyway, it's just wonderful. And so, on one hand, okay, so here it is. I mean, this clearly exists somewhere in nature. You have to ask yourself, what were they thinking? What was, I mean, this costs some money, right? To like put this out there and on this road, and to imagine that somebody is like going to be inconvenienced. What are they going to do? They're going to stop and go, oh,
but
darn.
We've seen this before. We saw a gate. Remember, you had a picture of the week that was a gate that people just went around,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. It's just, oh, okay.
It just shows that if you're going to build a fence, you got to build a pretty long fence.
Yeah. Anyway, I've had this for a long time.
I love it.
Nothing else on the radar this week. So I thought, okay, it's time just to say, what were they thinking? Because you could argue this is dumber than the password entry lock where the password is written above it. Because at least there you could, like, if you just changed your mind, you could take the password off and change the combo. Here, it's like, okay, I mean, I guess they could strengthen this by putting fencing around it. I mean, basically, nothing about this is defensible. I mean, there's no actual way, as you can see from the picture, to prevent somebody who's on the outside from coming onto the inside or escaping, if that's what this is trying. It's not clear what direction this is trying to control. Anyway, this is just nuts. So it's a great example of security not really working. Windows XP, Leo, and I said that correctly, not Windows 8, not Windows 7, Windows XP was patched last week.
I know.
For the second Tuesday of May.
Well, maybe XP, more accurately to say a patch was offered because it wasn't automatic.
Correct. So you know something is worrying Microsoft deeply.
Yeah.
When they're willing to reach back to Windows XP and produce, I mean, they don't even want to keep 7 current, you know, like for like the Spectrum meltdown stuff. We don't have even now complete updates for all versions of Windows 7 for that, because, you know, there's a strong push, as we know. I've now twice had the warning come up that all security for Windows 7 is being discontinued. So we want to help you get your ducks in a row to move to Windows 10 before February of next year. And it's like, okay, well, my ducks are fine. Thank you very much. we'll see what happens. Anyway, so this is XP. Simon Pope, the director of incident response with the Microsoft Security Response Center, the MSRC, titled his announcement posting as a plea, with the headline, "Prevent a Worm by Updating Remote Desktop Services." He said, "Today, Microsoft released fixes for a critical remote code execution vulnerability. It was given CVE number 2019-0708 in remote desktop services, formerly known as terminal services, that affects some older versions of Windows." And their announcement says the remote desktop protocol, which, of course, we talk about often, RDP itself, he says, is not vulnerable. Okay, well, that's sort of a technicality. He says this vulnerability is pre-authentication and requires no user interaction. In other words, the vulnerability is wormable, meaning that any future malware that exploits this vulnerability could propagate from vulnerable computer to vulnerable computer in a similar way as the WannaCry malware spread across the globe in 2017. While we have observed no exploitation of this vulnerability, this is Microsoft saying it is highly likely that malicious actors will write an exploit for this vulnerability and incorporate it into their malware. And now I have to say that I love the fact that the world is finally sitting up and taking sober responsibility for these sorts of problems. We know that anyone can make a mistake and that such mistakes can go unseen for years, as indeed this one did, because it existed in Windows XP from day one, and sometimes even for decades. So it's not the fact of the mistake that matters. It's how those who are responsible for fixing it deal with that responsibility. So this is, I have to say, another bravo for Microsoft. You know, on the other hand, they didn't really have much choice. Simon continues his posting saying, "Now that I have your attention, it is important that affected systems are patched as quickly as possible to prevent such a scenario from happening. In response, we are taking the unusual step of providing a security update for all customers to protect Windows platforms, including some out-of-support versions of Windows." He says vulnerable in-support systems, meaning those that are still receiving updates, include Windows 7, Windows Server 2008 R2, and Windows Server 2008. But that means specifically Windows 8, 8.1, and 10 are not vulnerable to this. So this is older versions of Windows. He said downloads for in-support versions of Windows can be found in the Microsoft Security Update Guide. Customers who use an in-support version of Windows and have automatic updates enabled are automatically protected. So, Leo, as you said, if you're in support and have auto updates, you'll be automatically protected. But unfortunately, earlier versions, out-of-support systems, he says, include Windows 2003 and Windows XP. If you are on an out-of-support version, the best way to address this vulnerability is to upgrade to the latest version of Windows. On the other hand, if you're running XP, maybe you'll have like, what, 2 gig of RAM. And
good luck.
Sorry.
Yeah.
He says, even so, we are making fixes available for these out-of-support versions of Windows. And then there's a KB for anyone who's listening. KB45005. So if you have XP, but it's worth saying, okay. So we'll cover this in a little more detail about what this means in a second. But I was just going to say that, you know, you'd have to be exposed in some way. Your instance of Windows desktop, remote terminal services, whatever you want to call it, remote desktop protocol, would have to have an exposure to the public. So you know, that's unlikely if you're behind a router. On the other hand, we'll talk about in a second, there's a lot of those. So they said customers running Windows 8 and Windows 10 are not affected by this vulnerability, and it is no coincidence, this is them stroking themselves, that later versions of Windows are unaffected. Mm. Microsoft invests heavily in strengthening the security of its products. I would argue it's probably a coincidence.
Yeah, but anyway. I find that hard to... We didn't fix it in any of the other versions, but we did fix it.
Yes, given the fact that, what was it now? I don't have the number in front of me. 79 vulnerabilities were fixed in Windows 10 this month. You know, again... So they said Microsoft invests heavily in strengthening the security of its products, often through major architectural improvements that are not possible to backport to earlier versions of Windows. There is partial mitigation, this is Microsoft, on affected systems that have network-level authentication, NLA, enabled. The affected systems are mitigated against wormable malware or advanced malware threats that could exploit the vulnerability, as NLA requires authentication before the vulnerability can be triggered. However, affected systems are still vulnerable to remote code execution exploitation if the attacker has valid credentials that can be used to successfully authenticate. Okay, so what that means is that we've been talking recently about all of these problems with RDP. I know I've said to our listeners over and over, there is no safe way to have this port 3389 publicly exposed. You just can't. I'm a big fan of remote desktop. It's super convenient. It's, you know, Windows is inherently GUI by nature. So it wants GUI administration. Consequently, you know, it's the way I remotely administer GRC's servers. But you will find no port 3389 or any other port listening on GRC's network that's got remote desktop protocol exposed. There is no possible safe way to have it exposed. So, RDP runs over a well-known port, 3389. So, not surprisingly, scanning the internet's IPv4 address space for instances of that port accepting TCP connections is trivial. Now get this, about 11 million IPv4 addresses are currently accepting connections on port 3389. And because people have looked more closely after their eyes bugged out, somewhere around 4.1 million of those IP addresses respond as RDP servers. Today, 4.1 million exposed RDP servers. That's insane, but it's the case. And it certainly explains and warrants Microsoft's deep concern when we absolutely know that some probably significant percentage of those will be XP, Windows 7, Server 2003, Server 2008, or Server 2008 R2 machines. So what we now know is that there is an exploit which will certainly be reverse engineered, which allows all of those 4.1 million RDP responding servers that are XP7 or any of those servers responding, this exploit allows them to be taken over remotely. And if they happen to have NLA enabled, which is not the norm, but if they did, then even those that we've been talking about whose credentials have been brute forced can now have remote code execution leveraged against them in order to allow the attackers to get more than they were able to before. So, although on the other hand, if you have a remote desktop protocol that gives the connector sufficient privileges, you've got effective remote code execution anyway, because you can send anything through that connection that you want to and then run it at the other end. So, okay. So just for the sake of our listeners, anyone who wishes, any individual or enterprise who wishes to make remote top desktop protocol available remotely must simply place it behind a VPN. That's all you have to do. Install an instance of OpenVPN server using certificate-based authentication. Set up an instance of one or more instances of OpenVPN clients with authorized client machines, giving them individual certificates signed by the server's private key. Now you have a robust means of managing a set of VPN clients who you can then selectively give access to remote desktop protocol through the VPN. You again, this, unfortunately, I mean, it's almost unfortunate that there's even a password on remote desktop protocol, because if there weren't one, well, I guess I don't mean that, because people still would put it on the public internet and go, oh, well, I guess we're not supposed to password protect it. But the point is, the password doesn't work, as we've seen, except on more recent versions of Windows. Now anybody can get to these things. So given that there are many millions of probably exploitable RDP servers that will probably not be updated, we're almost certainly going to see this. We'll be talking about this a month or two from now, that, you know, the RDP worm that hit. You know, to their credit, again, Microsoft did what they could. They offered a patch to old systems that are probably online, but as we have so often seen, probably not going to get patched, probably never going to get patched. And now they're going to get taken over as soon as some miscreants reverse engineer this problem, knowing, first of all, that there is a patch, looking at the patch, see what got changed. I mean, we have all the tools are in place. The skill set is in place. It's going to happen. So we don't know that they will create a worm. In this day and age, they'll probably just infect them with crypto miners and, you know, hopefully that they're, you know, hope that they're running powerful servers that they can use for mining cryptocurrency, and they'll just suck all of the CPU cycles out of those. Or maybe they'll do a worm. The point was that Microsoft said it was wormable because it required absolutely no user interaction, just like WannaCry, where if it was able to get into a system, then it was able to do so autonomously, didn't require anything to then be able to turn around and start scanning for more vulnerable systems. Well, now we have Shodan, which is the way we know that there are 11 million open 3389 ports, and 4.1 of those respond to the remote desktop protocol. There's no question that a heavy percentage of those are going to be older machines that are not going to get patched. So we will likely be talking about, the other shoe to drop on this one before long. And as I said, security is hard to do, Leo.
Yeah.
Boy.
This has probably been in this forever, right? I mean, this is not.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. It's been in the original Windows XP. When was that?
Oh,
that was,
geez,
what?
20 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's interesting. I mean, it doesn't.
It finally came to light. And,
right.
And so this is why, as we've been saying, it really is necessary. And we're there now, but we weren't there 20 years ago, for updates to automatically be installed in, like, for systems to reach out to somewhere and check to see whether there are updates available. And it's worth noting, I don't know if anybody has tried to set up XP. I do from time to time. In fact, I had to do it last week because somebody who was testing an update to the Squirrel client for Windows, mine, GRCs that I've written, had a problem. I made some changes. I would have to look at my notes to remember what they were, but I had to set up a Windows XP. Well, Windows XP no longer is able to even get updates because Microsoft changed the Windows update format. And so you have to go manually go get an update to update and update before it's able to update anything else. And so, you know, it's like even the update won't update unless you first update it, which is sort of, you know, like, wait a minute.
Huh?
Why?
Tell me that again.
Yeah. So anyway, Microsoft and Adobe both released their regularly scheduled patches last Tuesday, second Tuesday of May. Microsoft's was 79 vulnerabilities, 22 of them labeled critical. Of the 22 vulnerabilities, 18 were in affected their various scripting engines and browsers, and the remaining four were remote code execution in, as we've just described, remote desktop. There was also one in DHCP server, one in the GDI Plus, the graphics device interface extension, and also one in Word. And of course, we, as we'll be talking about later, Microsoft also released some what they called it guidance for the recently disclosed so-called microarchitectural data sampling, now called MDS techniques, that we'll get to. Adobe on its patch Tuesday fixed one problem in Flash. It's nice that, you know, they stopped messing with it, so they're not creating new problems, but they're still finding older ones. On the other hand, there were also problems in Acrobat and Reader and also Media Encoder. As I said, Flash only got one fix. Media Encoder had two fixes. Acrobat and Reader, 83 vulnerabilities in those. Because again, if you just keep stirring the code, you're going to keep creating new problems, and that's what we keep seeing. There were four remote code execution vulnerabilities. I did a little bit of digging, and I could not determine whether the Windows DHCP server problem, which is a remote code vulnerability and is ranked critical, whether that affected it on the for its receiving packets on the from the public side, or that is on the WAN side or on the LAN side. You know, a DHCP server is, for example, maybe standing in for DNS, and so it's telling all of the clients on the LAN side to refer to it for DNS, so then it's turning around and making DNS queries on behalf of its clients. That's sometimes the way things are configured, but it's oftentimes the case that DHCP server will be making public queries. What has come to light is that there is a way to provide a malformed reply packet to the Windows DHCP servers in order to cause a remote code execution vulnerability. As a consequence, for enterprise customers especially, this has jumped up to the top of the must patch immediately. You know, here we are a week downstream. Hopefully, IT people who are responsible already, you know, understood that this was important and fixed it, because once again, what we're seeing is that vulnerabilities are being reverse engineered and are being weaponized very quickly. The other problems are these other 22 vulnerabilities are remote code execution, privilege of elevation, and, you know, our regular cast of characters. For the zero-day initiative blog post last Tuesday, Dustin Childs, who's Trend Micro's communications manager, wrote, he said, speaking of this, these vulnerabilities, they would first need to gain access to run code on a target system, but malware often uses elevations like this one. So there was one that was not remote code execution, but it was an elevation of privilege, and we've been talking about this. They use elevations like this one to go from user to admin code execution. There are no details provided for this, but they are being used in limited attacks in the wild. So again, this is one of those, let's definitely get this patched. And with any luck, all of the people listening to this podcast have done so, you know, soon after knowing that it was Patch Tuesday time. I want to talk about an exploit that doesn't technically have a name, Leo. Unfortunately, the people who found this and have weaponized it and will be discussing it at length this summer at the Black Hat Conference 2019, decided to name it with three emojis.
Oh.
I know.
An exploit has no name would have been better.
Yeah, so much like the artist formerly known as Prince.
Oh, impossible.
Whose name
what are the
is
emojis?
Simple. So they are three angry cats.
Well, and so that's they're, the name, three angry cats.
So they're saying if you must have some way to refer to it, they recommend Thrangry Cat.
Thrangry Cat.
Thrangry Cat.
That's
so,
a terrible name for an exploit.
It's awful. Let's take our second break, and then we will dig into something that Thrangry Cat. Thrangry yes, it's cat. Bad. And what's significant is, unfortunately, this is bad enough that, as I said, financial institutions are worrying about Cisco's stock price.
Oh boy!
Because it affects hundreds of millions of deployed routers, switches, and firewalls. And if when you scroll through the list, I mean, it's like it's hundreds of individual devices that Cisco makes deployed in hundreds of millions of publicly accessible locations, and it is remotely exploitable. So, yes, the cats are Thrangry.
Thangry.
Thangry.
Thangry. I'm Thangry. Oh, Steve. Our show today brought to you by, here we go, we could blog at wordpress.com and express our thanger. That's where my blog is, leolaporte.com. Link to it. Tell your friends. leolaporte.com. It's on wordpress.com, and that is easily the best place to make your presence on the internet felt. WordPress is a great content management system, the best there is. I started using it when it first came out. I've been on WordPress.com for 12 years because I realized, why am I hosting this? Why am I maintaining it? Why am I updating it? Let WordPress.com do the heavy lifting for less than you're paying for your existing server. And by the way, all the most powerful site building tools, the themes, the plugins, and WordPress.com offers 24/7 support from real WordPress experts. People use it every day. I love WordPress.com because they're doing the good work, the good deed of letting anyone, wherever you are, whoever you are, pursue whatever it is you love, to put your flag on the internet, to tell the world who you are, to show your best stuff. And by the way, if you know a teenager, get them to go to WordPress.com and do this, because there's where you launch a site that's free to start and has all the room in the world to grow. I started with the free tier myself. I am now on the business tier because there's lots of features I really appreciate, including some really great additional plugins. And you can even do e-commerce on WordPress.com. WordPress.com has no two-week trials, no hidden fees. And most importantly, the reason I say you have to have your own place on the web, you own the content. It's your content. Upload whatever you want, pictures, images, movies, sound, music, and download it again if you want to get it out of there. You're never trapped. You own your content forever. WordPress.com is built to grow with you to get where you want to be tomorrow. And when somebody comes to you and says, where should I start my website? You know what to say, WordPress.com/security now. If they go there, they'll get 15% off any new plan purchase. I love WordPress. So powerful, so flexible. Many of the biggest sites on the internet, content sites on the internet, like Fortune.com and Quartz, use WordPress. Millions of people use WordPress.com every day to turn their dreams into reality. And I'll give you the real statistic. 1/3 of the entire internet runs on WordPress. Now, what do you say? WordPress.com/security now. 15% off any new plan purchase. WordPress.com/security now. Thank you, WordPress, for doing such a great job supporting the world and supporting Security Now, our podcast. Yeah, that's a big part of the world for me anyway. And thank you, Security Now listeners, for using that URL, because that tells them you heard it here. And you get 15% off. WordPress.com/security now. Thank you, WordPress. All right, Steve, what's next?
So a new and very serious vulnerability present in hundreds of millions of Cisco routers, switches, and firewalls.
Jeez.
Yeah. Investorplace.com noted, quote, Cisco earnings were great, but beware ThangriCat. Cisco's latest security weakness is something to consider if looking to buy, unquote. So, I mean, it's really shaking things up. And I'm not that impressed with Cisco's handling of this. We'll get to that in a second. They go on to say that they have no idea what to make of Red Balloon's description. That's the group that found this and did some very seriously good engineering. I just wish, you know, ThangriCat was, well, I mean, I guess I wouldn't mind it if that was the official name, but no, they've decided to name it as three emojis. Okay, so the security firm is Red Balloon. They've identified a vulnerability, actually two, and in the first case have received a CVE of 2019-1649. And yes, it's known. I have the picture of the three unhappy looking cats in the show notes. And it doesn't look like they printed well. When I created the PDF, they just show as little blacked out shadows on the show notes. So it's another reason why you don't want to do this.
It's not in mine. I guess yours. You know what? The computer you're using probably doesn't have the pouting cats.
Well, no. So you have the big three ones, but if you scroll down, I actually embedded the name throughout the text.
It works. So,
yeah. Oh,
I think your computer doesn't have the requisite emojis.
Right. It does show on yours.
It looks cute, in fact.
Okay. Well, are you on a Mac?
I am on a Mac.
So ThangriCat affects multiple Cisco products that support. Oh, and Leo, if you scroll down, there's a Cisco link. Look at the list of stuff in their disclosure. Oh my goodness, it's the list of their hardware. It's everything they've been doing. So okay, so I'll back up. ThangriCat affects multiple Cisco products that support. Okay, this is Cisco's own proprietary, they call it the Trust Anchor Module, TAM.
Is that Secure Boot or?
Yes, it's okay. Their version. As its name suggests, the Trust Anchor Module is a critical component of Cisco's hardware-based Secure Boot functionality, which has been implemented in nearly all of Cisco's enterprise devices. God. Since 2013.
Well, that explains the length of this list.
I know.
I
know.
Holy cow.
So they came up with this and they said, oh, this is wonderful. Let's put this everywhere. Let's put this on everything. Secure Boot. It promises to ensure that the firmware, as we know with Secure Boot, running on hardware platforms is authentic and unmodified. Unfortunately, it turns out that's a promise it's unable to keep. In the words of its discoverers, Red Balloon Security Inc., they wrote, is disclosing two vulnerabilities affecting the products of Cisco Systems Inc. The first, known as, and there you have the three icons, the three cat heads, I'll just say Thangri, since, you know, that's what we have to do, allows an attacker to fully bypass Cisco's Trust Anchor Module via Field Programmable Gate Array, that's FPGA, bitstream manipulation. The second vulnerability is a remote command injection vulnerability against Cisco's iOS XE version 16 that allows remote code execution as root by changing the Thangri and remote command injection vulnerabilities. I'm sorry, by chaining the Thangri and remote command injection vulnerabilities, an attacker can remotely and persistently bypass Cisco's secure boot mechanism and lock out all future software updates to the Trust Anchor module, the TAM. Fangry, they write, is caused by a series of hardware design flaws within Cisco's Trust Anchor module. First commercially introduced in 2013, Cisco's Trust Anchor module is a proprietary hardware security module used in a wide range of Cisco products, including enterprise routers, switches, and firewalls. TAM is the root of trust that underpins all other Cisco security and trustworthy computing mechanisms in these devices. In other words, they put all their eggs in that basket, and then the eggs broke. Fangry allows an attacker to make persistent modification to the Trust Anchor module via FPGA bitstream modification, thereby defeating the secure boot process and invalidating Cisco's chain of trust at its root. While the flaws are based in hardware, Fangry can be exploited remotely. There again, the flaws are based in hardware. Fangry can be exploited remotely without any need for physical access. Since the flaws reside within the hardware design, it is unlikely that any software security patch will fully resolve the fundamental security vulnerability. So, we've not, on this podcast, talked about FPGA bitstream programming before. As we know, we have talked about FPGAs, field programmable gate arrays. An FPGA, field programmable, as its name suggests, is a means for creating soft hardware. It's a massive array of logical hardware elements like AND gates, OR gates, selectors, and such that can be dynamically configured with RAM that is loaded into it. So the idea is that you have an outboard small EEPROM or PROM, which at power up produces a bit stream which this FPGA sucks into itself in order to turn it from just this massive generic unprogrammed blob into a piece of hardware. And I mean, and these, the FPGAs these days have gotten unbelievably powerful. You can implement full processors in FPGAs that run at full processor speed. They're not, because they're generic, they're not as efficient as if you actually, you know, did a masked programmed array, or, you know, actually designed the chip that you want. But you can do full on, you know, real hardware this way. So the problem here is that something that Cisco did wrong allows this bitstream to be manipulated such that the hardware root of trust is corruptible. From their Q&A answering the question, how widespread is this, they explain, this vulnerability affects Cisco products with an FPGA-based TAM. Cisco released their list of more than 100 product families containing this vulnerability. And as I said, Leo, it's a horrifying list. I mean, it's like everything that they've done for the last 6 years. So they asked themselves the question, what are the implications of demonstrating modification of the FPGA bitstream? They write, our findings support the practical exploitation of FPGA-based devices via direct bitstream analysis and modification. So they reverse engineered the bitstream on one device that they got their hands on, took a look at it, and And as so often the case, you know, we've talked about how difficult it is to write code that interprets securely, because the people writing the interpreter just it's so difficult to take an adversarial posture. It takes an adversary to have an adversarial posture. Well, these guys had that. And so they looked at what Cisco did and said, aha, and, you know, realized that there were some problems here. So they said, through our research, we developed a series of techniques to reliably add, subtract, and alter FPGA behavior without any need to perform register transfer level, that's RTL reconstruction, which is to say an RTL is one of the languages used for dealing with FPGAs. It's the way you describe this. So they didn't need to make a complete change to like rewrite the behavior of the whole thing. They were able to edit some of that in order to cause a degradation of security, which probably is not that difficult to do. You know, any change that you make is going to do something that is non-optimal, and it's certainly not going to increase its security any. It has the reverse effect. So they said, by demonstrating successful FPGA modification on the Xilinx Spartan 6 LX45T, which presumably is the FPGA that Cisco chose, we find that our bitstream manipulation techniques present a range of potential applications for persistent FPGA implants, physical destruction of embedded systems, and attacks against FPGA-based systems, such as software-defined radios, advanced automotive driver assist modules, weapons guidance systems, and more. Then they asked themselves in their Q&A, had these vulnerabilities been exploited in the wild? They answer, we are unaware of any use of this exploit in the wild, but the potential danger is severe. What action could be taken? They answer, please consult Cisco's official security advisory. We did not receive early access to Cisco's security patch and will be analyzing the patches as they are made publicly available. Since Thangri, and I mean, it is angry, is fundamentally a hardware design flaw, we believe it will be very difficult.
Boy.
If, yes, yes, yes. It will be very difficult, if not impossible, to fully resolve this vulnerability via software patch.
Yikes.
So, yeah. Okay, so as I mentioned, I was unimpressed with Cisco's own vulnerability disclosure because, doubtless in something of a panic, they downplayed the problem's severity. They wrote, quote, a vulnerability in the logic that handles access control to one of the hardware components in Cisco's proprietary secure boot implementation could allow an unauthenticated local, it also works remotely, attacker to write a modified firmware image to the component. Okay, that's technically true, but not only local. This vulnerability affects multiple Cisco products that support hardware-based secure boot functionality. So yes, right out of the mouth of an attorney, it's not incorrect, but boy, it doesn't characterize, you know, the nature of the problem. Cisco continues, the vulnerability is due to an improper check on the area of code that manages on-premise updates to a field programmable gate array part of the secure boot hardware implementation. An attacker with elevated privileges and access to the underlying operating system, okay, both which these these Thangri people, the red balloon people, demonstrated that is running on the affected device could exploit this vulnerability by writing a modified firmware image to the FPGA. In other words, the FPGA and Cisco's basically confirmed what the Thangri exploit is, which is the bitstream can be changed. The TAM module that anchors secure boot depends upon it not being changed. Therefore, secure boot can be bypassed. Cisco continues, a successful exploit could either cause the device to become unstable and require a hardware replacement or allow tampering with the secure boot verification process, which, under some circumstances, may allow the attacker to install and boot a malicious software image. So, since 2013, Cisco has had a secure boot trust anchor in hardware that now these people demonstrate across their devices, apparently all of them, based on Cisco's own list, can be compromised. There is a remote compromise available. So these guys are going to be demonstrating it in Vegas at Black Hat 2019, and they allege this cannot be fixed in software. So this has got to just be Cisco's worst nightmare. Cryptocurrency hacks are still growing. We've not talked about, you know, we talked about Bitcoin before it was a big deal. We talked about it, I'm sorry to say, back when it was possible for a Core i7 running overnight to generate a Bitcoin, as mine did.
Actually, or 50.
50.
We're around $35,000 right now.
Yes, and then I reformatted the hard drive.
Oh, you did? You killed the wallet?
Yeah, I killed the wallet. Yeah.
Well, yeah. It was expensive.
It was expensive because it peaked just shy of $20,000 per coin.
That was really expensive.
Oh, boy.
That's $1 million?
Thank you, Leo. Yes.
Like a million?
That was an expensive reformat operation. And yes, I'm sure that the underlying data is gone because I then reinstalled Windows on top.
Didn't you have it in a wallet, though?
Yeah, but I didn't take it seriously.
And you didn't keep the wallet ID or anything like that? Because you could wallet.dat, you could get it all back.
No, well, that was on the hard drive.
Yeah, okay.
And so that's what got obliterated.
So kids, back up your wallet.dat. And by the way, if you password protect it, don't do as Leo did and forget the password.
Well, I'm sure back then I was using a password, one of a few that I'm almost sure I would have.
That's
been
what
able
I
to
thought.
Get.
Yeah, but I did back up my wallet.dat. I have that, and I was, you know, I'm able to rebuild the wallet. If you just have that little file, you can rebuild the wallet, but then you need to unlock it.
Well,
have seven. You got 50, dude.
Yeah. Cryptocurrencies have enjoyed a recent resurgence. I don't know. I didn't look at it recently. I didn't look at it today. But, you know, they spent a long time wallowing down around $4,000 for a Bitcoin. And it's about doubled last time I looked, around $8,000. So anyway, but where are we? We've talked a lot recently about CoinHive and about browser-based mining. We haven't checked in on the larger cryptocurrency world recently. There's a nice publication that I keep an eye on, The Hacker News. They have some good writers, and they pull pieces together sometimes. They wrote up an interesting summary snapshot with information gleaned from several different sources, including an outfit called CipherTrace, that did a 2018 cryptocurrency report. So I did with a bit of paraphrasing for length and a bit of editing for size, I wanted to share what the Hacker News wrote. They wrote, though once synonymous with underground networks and black hat hackers, Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies have gone mainstream over the past 2 years. In 2017, we saw the skyrocketing of Bitcoin to an all-time high of close to $20,000, followed by a significant decline the following year. But beyond the ups and downs in the market for the world's largest cryptocurrency is a much more sinister story, revolving around cyber attacks of the economy's newest asset class. In 2018, it's estimated that as much as $1.7 billion worth of – that's U.S. dollar billion, $1.7 billion worth of cryptocurrencies were swindled away from investors. And they said, perens, likely more,
yeah,
through a variety of means. And, you know, I've been talking about this, and we see this going on in the news all the time. Whether accomplished through hacking, phishing, or other forms of scamming, it's clear that the crypto industry is facing a serious dilemma with security. For a technological movement based on decentralization and the advantages it offers for security, the number of breaches occurring is startling. They wrote, cryptocurrencies offer users a way to send money without the need for a third party. Yet the industry as a whole is dealing with more security vulnerabilities than centralized financial firms doing the same thing. During the same period, more traditional companies that transfer money and banks have seen nowhere near the same amount of issues with hackers. So what's the problem? While cryptocurrencies and blockchain technology are decentralized in nature, there are many aspects of the cryptosphere that aren't. The number one culprit in 2018, and we know this from watching, was cryptocurrency exchanges. Unlike the underlying technology behind currencies like Bitcoin, Ether, and Litecoin, cryptocurrency exchanges are centralized and not yet regulated to the same extent as most financial firms. According to data from CipherTrace's 2018 cryptocurrency report, 950 million of the total 1.7 billion stolen were from exchanges and infrastructure services. Exchange services are a particular pain point for the industry because they're one of the easiest ways for users to get started with cryptocurrencies, as some even handle fiat currency. So anyway, I won't go on. I have more in the show notes if anyone is interested. But basically, this tells us, you know, what we already know, which is, and what we've seen, which is that we're seeing lots of startup Me Too exchanges, and you know, if you build it, they will come. They collect a bunch of money, and whether it's an insider job, sometimes the people running the firms are accused of like faking the loss or faking an exterior attack. Sometimes they probably are, as we know. Security is difficult, and if these things are not well designed, it's also the case that over time you generally mature your security. Hopefully, it gets better over time. So anything brand new where there's lots of money involved, you're going to have people trying to poke it. And when it's a virtual currency, theft is electronic. So anyway, I just thought it was interesting to get a sense of scale. On one hand, sure, there's a lot of glamour behind this. On the other hand, boy, you know, if you actually do have any substantial wealth in online coin, be very careful where you have it stored, because it's like there's just been a long history of these problems.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people would say, "Oh, Steve, you should just put it on, you know, Coinbase, and you'd be fine." or Mt. Gox. If you guys had just put it in the Mt. Gox, you'd be fine. Both of us had the good sense not to do that. I would have feel a little bit worse if, you know, it was stolen than if we just lost it out of.
Well, Leo, I mean, remember, stupidity. Back then, none of this existed.
Yeah, it was all made up. I mean, yeah,
to
exactly.
To our credit, we did a podcast explaining what the blockchain was when no one had ever heard the term before.
True.
So, you know, it's, I mean, otherwise, boy, if I, you know, if when I mean, I know that the drive was formatted because I went back and retraced my steps because I, for a while I was saying, oh, I think it might be on a computer back behind
some boxes.
It might be
in the corner. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought, And so finally I thought, okay, let's get serious about this, Gibson. And so I went back and I absolutely verified. I know which machine it's on. I know which one it was on. I remembered running this thing overnight, waking up and going. And then I reported to our listeners, hey, you know, remember when I said I was running a little miner? Well, turns
out
the next day I had 50 Bitcoin.
Right.
It's like, woohoo. Well, boohoo.
On the flip side, it didn't cost us anything to create.
That's true. Yeah. I do like to earn my money, but still, you know, free money. Ouch. Yeah. Anyway. Okay. So we have a little bit of comic relief here on a podcast that needs some. Matthew Green, whose full name is Matthew Daniel Green, our oft-quoted cryptographer and security technologist. He's an associate professor of computer science at Johns Hopkins Information Security Institute. He got himself a bit worked up over the details of the recent flaw discovered in the configuration of Google's Titan Bluetooth security dongles. So probably anybody who has one has already received email from Google. Google's very good about communication. Google is sending out replacements. If yours is marked with a T1 or T2 down in the bottom of the back of it, then it's vulnerable. I've got a link here, Leo, to Matthew's Twitter stream, but I also have it in the show notes. So first of all, Matthew quotes from the Bluetooth spec. He has a screenshot, which I reproduced here. Reading from the Bluetooth spec, get this, listeners. The encryption key, K-sub-C, is derived from the current link key and may vary in single byte increments from 1 byte. What? Okay, the encryption
one byte?
Key.
In from let me see. There's 15 possible choices.
From 16. 1 byte to 16 bytes in length.
Oh.
As set during a negotiation process that occurs between the master and slave devices. During this negotiation, a master device makes a key size suggestion for the slave.
Mm-hmm. I suggest one.
How does that sound? Then you get to choose between any one of 256 keys. Jeez.
Well, that should be enough for anybody.
Who needs more than that? The spec says the initial key size suggested by the master is programmed into the controller by the manufacturer.
Well,
and is not always 16 bytes.
That's like a new kind of security, right? You don't know what it is.
That's right.
Yeah.
In production implementations, a, quote, minimum acceptable, unquote, key size parameter can be set to prevent a malicious user from driving the key size down to the minimum of 1 byte, which would make the link less secure. It actually says, which would make the link less secure.
A lot less.
Oh, yeah. A 1 byte key? Really? So Matthew, after posting this screenshot from the spec, Matthew tweets, like, what kind of idiot protocol lets users negotiate a, quote, maximum key size that can be as small as 1 byte.
Now, this is a Bluetooth spec, not a Google spec, we should point
correct.
Out.
Correct. This is Bluetooth.
Yeah.
He says, parens, a default that, fortunately, should be higher in more recent versions. He continues. This is Matthew Green, quoted on Twitter. don't rely on Bluetooth security protocols for anything ever. Just treat them like a particularly inefficient version of Base 64 encoding, unquote.
I like this line. Keep going.
He says, quote, what would you possibly do with a one-byte key? Is anyone at Bluetooth SIG even awake when these idiot decisions get made? He says, quote, hey, maybe we should call some experts and ask them if one byte is a good minimum size for an encryption key. Nah, we've got all the expertise we need right here. That's 256 whole keys. Then he tweeted, Bluetooth, and I didn't get this reference, but he explained
it. Oh, I get it. Next. Yeah,
he says, Bluetooth is the Michael Bay movie of encryption protocols. And I thought, huh? And he explains, it doesn't make any effing, and he didn't say effing, he used the whole word, he says, it doesn't make any effing sense. And then it explodes.
That's a Michael Bay movie in a nutshell.
He says, and then somebody tweeting as Tybor Jagger, who is enjoying Mike Green's tirade, adds, I like the way they use the phrase less secure, to which Matthew tweets in reply, what could it possibly be less secure than? Okay, so what's Matthew so worked up about? It seems that a team of security researchers at Microsoft discovered a serious vulnerability in the Bluetooth version of Google's Titan security keys. Okay, now remember, everybody, these are the ones that everyone is using today, right? The T1 and T2 versions right now until last week. A serious vulnerability that cannot be patched with a software update. So Google has announced that it will replace all affected keys at no charge. Thank you, Google. In their security advisory published Wednesday, Google said a, quote, misconfiguration in the Titan security keys Bluetooth pairing protocols, unquote, could allow an attacker who is physically close to your security key, which is to say within 30 feet, to communicate. That's, you know, not bad, 30 feet, to communicate with it or the device to which your key is paired. And we know from Matthew that this misconfiguration allows the use of a one-byte key. As we covered at the time last summer, the Titan security key system consists of a USB dongle to provide hardware-based two-factor authentication for online accounts, which require the highest level of protection against phishing attacks. Google sells actually a pair. For the highest level, you need two. Sells for $50 in the Google Store a pair, which is a USB security key with NFC and a battery-powered micro USB equipped for recharging Bluetooth NFC key, which is used for multi-factor. Actually,
and that's really used on iOS because iOS doesn't support either USB or NFC. So right. Everywhere else you can use the other secure key, but on iOS you have to use a Bluetooth key.
Right, and then for something, it's one of their things that you have to have both. That you're like there.
You have to own both. If you want to use Google's. I forgot what they call it, but the high-end security, which I've done, I set up, you have to, and it doesn't have to be the Google pair. You can get a Bluetooth, but they want you to have both a Bluetooth security key and a hardware security key.
Ah.
But you don't need to use both. Either one will do.
So anyway, according to Google, the vulnerability only affects the Bluetooth low energy, the BLE version of the Titan security keys that have a T1 or T2. That's for Terminator 1 or Terminator 2, sign on, I don't know what it stands for, on the back. Other non-Bluetooth security keys, USB or NFC supported versions are safe to use. So as Matthew says, he's not a fan, obviously, of blue. He would consider Bluetooth security, that phrase, to be an oxymoron.
They had to do it because of iOS, and that's less important now because Apple's opened up the NFC on iPhones. So it would really it was for legacy support more than anything else. You could get away with just a YubiKey with the NFC now.
So the attack scenarios, Google's cloud product manager, Christian Brand, described in a blog in Google's blog post. He said, when you're signing into an account on your device, you're normally asked to press the button on your BLE security key to activate it. An attacker in close physical proximity, okay, but, you know, 30 feet, at that moment in time, can potentially connect their own device to your affected security key before your own device connects. In this set of circumstances, the attacker could sign into your account using their own device if the attacker somehow already obtained your username and password and could time these events exactly. So, not the end of the world, but it certainly defeats the multi-factorness, which is why you have this whole thing in the first place. And then he continues, before you can use your security key, it must be paired to your device. Once paired, an attacker in close physical proximity to you could use their device to masquerade as your affected security key and connect to your device at the moment you are asked to press the button on your key. After that, they could attempt to change their device to appear as a Bluetooth keyboard or mouse and potentially take actions on your device. So anyway, Microsoft, as I mentioned, initially discovered the vulnerability and reported it to Google quietly, as well as to Phytium, that's the company that makes these Titan keys for Google and also sells the same product under the trademark ePass, which is its own brand. They also made a coordinated disclosure about the vulnerability the same day as Google and offered the same sort of free replacement program for their own users. Anyway, so
it's a Bluetooth LE issue, isn't it? This is part of the LE spec. LE's always made me a little nervous, to be honest.
And the spec has been improved subsequently. Good. But again, why did it ever say that you could negotiate down to a one-byte key? I mean,
there must have been a reason, like some dumb hardware or something.
Or something really
Keyboards.
Underpowered.
Keyboards. Yeah. Remember they had, we mentioned this years ago that a number of Bluetooth keyboards used, what was it, ROT 13 or something for the encryption key.
Yeah, they weren't even Bluetooth. They were just low-energy radio.
Logitech wireless.
And so every time you hit a key, it incremented a counter that was XORed with the ASCII of the key.
XOR,
oh, boy. Yeah. I mean, that would be a beautiful... Not even a grad project. It would be a
middle school.
It would be a nice high school. Project for a class. Yeah. You know, crack this keyboard.
They're probably all still using them. I bet you there are plenty of them in there.
No doubt.
Yeah.
So we did have an iOS update. We're now at 12.3. Once again, I don't know what it is with me. Maybe Apple just rolls these out slowly.
They do. They stagger.
Because it wasn't. I mean, this happened last week. But when I was pulling the show notes together last night, I thought, oh, really? So I went into general settings in my iPhone, and said, got anything for me? And he said, oh yeah, we got an update.
Yeah.
Download and install. It's like, okay, fine.
Microsoft does this too. That's Microsoft calls that being a seeker. If you're a seeker of an update, they will give you the update, but they don't alert you to it until later. So, but you will eventually get an alert saying, hey, there's an update.
Oh, yeah. And I do on some devices that I don't really care about or use often. Right. And it'll be like, I'll look and I'll see the little red,
a little tag
in the badge.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, oh, I guess it's something I'm supposed to be doing here. So anyway, they fixed 42 CVE designations, 20 of which, not surprisingly or unusually, were in WebKit. So about half of them affected, the public facing side of iOS, which is the browser based. And as we know, Apple tends to be the most tight-lipped of all companies about their vulnerabilities. There are a couple that jumped out. There was one, CVE-2019-8585, which affects Core Audio. The suggestion that I've seen is that it might give malware a route to compromise an iOS device using a malicious movie file. If that's the case, it would be serious, since it's probably not necessary for the target victim to do anything. If, for example, they were just watching, if they were just receiving it through a text, or maybe if it was displayed on a website, it might be able to get into their system. There's another one, 8593, was the Apple File Conduit. And 8605 in the kernel, either of which might allow someone to gain system privileges. So anyway, we don't know much more, probably won't. I heard you talking, I thought it was interesting, Leo, on MacBreak Weekly about the prevalence of intrusions into iOS.
Oh, how, yeah. You know, like, it's an interesting
really,
story.
At the state level, there is a lot of that going on.
Yeah, well, we just don't know because Apple's so locked down, it's impossible to kind of look at an iPhone and see if it's infected.
Right.
There's no Process Explorer or anything like that.
So I guess what you'd have to do is what? Just like do a complete wipe and reload from time to time. And then just be really careful about. I mean, the overwhelming. I think the best possible advice is, you know, not to just download everything that crosses your path, if possible. Or if you do, recognize that everything you download, you are trusting to some level, because it's very difficult for these systems to be kept secure. I did want to mention. As I mentioned at the top of the show, we've got a problem that is occurring to some set of people after last Tuesday's Windows 10 updates. Microsoft has acknowledged, and they're calling it a known problem. Well, it's known now. That's causing some users' systems to freeze. Leo, you may get people calling you on your show on the weekend. This occurs when users have created a restore point before applying the updates, and then for whatever reason, subsequently decide they want to back out of the updates, which of course should be fine, since that's the whole point of having a checkpoint, you know, having a restore point. It turns out that after this past Tuesday's updates, when users attempt to do this, their system is bricked. They get a stop error. You cannot do anything more. I have it in the show notes, a link to, if this has affected anybody or anybody who knows somebody who has been affected by this, there is a process you can go through. It's detailed and, it's not fun. You need to intercept the boot. I'm skipping over a bunch of this because I don't want to go into it in too much detail. Intercept the boot, get into the Win 10 restore environment, the rescue environment, and then jump through a bunch of hoops. Microsoft explains, they said, in this scenario, the system is not restored. Oh, so they said, imagine this. This is them speaking. You cannot restore the system to a restore point after you install a Windows 10 update. Consider the following scenario. You install Windows 10 on a clean computer. You turn on system protection and then create a system restore point that is named R1. You install one or more Windows 10 updates. After the updates have finished installing, you restore the system to the R1 restore point. In this scenario, the system is not restored to the R1 restore point. Instead, the computer experiences a stop error. You restart the computer, but the system cannot return to the Windows desktop. Under cause, they say this is a known issue in Windows 10. During the system restore process, Windows temporarily stages the restoration of files that are in use. It then saves the information in the registry. When the computer restarts, it completes the staged operation. In this situation, Windows restores the catalog files and stages the driver.sys files to be restored when the computer restarts. However, when the computer restarts, Windows loads the existing drivers before it restores the later versions of the drivers. Because the driver versions do not match the versions of the restored catalog files, the restart process stops. So I have no idea what they just said, except it bricks Windows. So for workaround, they say to recover from the failed restart, after the failure occurs, you should be able to restart the computer and then enter the Windows Recovery Environment, WinRE. To do this, you may have to use a hardware restart switch, and you may have to restart two times, and then they go on. So for what it's worth, again, another month and another problem with Windows 10 updates. And boy, they really do seem to be having a problem with this. Also wanted to mention that yesterday, Monday, what would that be? The May 20th, Edge, Microsoft's Edge for Mac OS was officially released. There's a website, Microsoft Edge Insider, all one word, MicrosoftEdgeInsider.com. And now, under the platform, you know, they're going to be doing a multi-platform release of Edge, not only for Windows 10 and eventually for Windows 7, but also for Mac. And so the Canary Channel version, which is the, you know, the rawest, the least stable, is officially available for download. There's a download button. You don't the links to pre-release versions leaked a week or two ago. So some people were playing with it. So I'm not sure who would want to run Edge on Mac OS, but if there's some reason you have for doing that, it's now officially sanctioned.
I think a lot of people, you know, play with Chrome and would be interested in an alternative, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, you've already got Chrome on Mac OS. So,
right.
Yeah.
Want to use it is on Windows.
Yes. And there, I think it makes lots of sense. Yep. Last week, I mentioned that tomorrow I will be giving a squirrel presentation to the May OWASP Los Angeles monthly dinner meeting in the Los Angeles area. At the time, there were 51 people signed up to attend. At this point, we have 76. So I don't know if there are regular members who were planning to go and show up, or it looks like maybe we'll have a bunch of Security Now listeners. So if that's the case, I look forward to being able to say hi to some of our listeners who I never really have the opportunity to meet.
Very nice.
So that'll be cool. And I need to take another sip of tea, Leo, then we're going to talk about CPU.fail.
Yes, which turns out there is a .fail TLD.
Yes.
Just and in the nick of time for the last season of Game of Thrones.
As I said, my subtitle is Speeding Up is Hard to Do.
We'll find out what that all means in a second, but let me first tell you, if you're an IT professional, you know that managing all your assets is always the biggest challenge. Well, okay. Biggest challenge is that guy Dave down the hall who can never figure out that his monitor's not plugged in. But after that, it is monitoring your entire IT environment. Imagine if you could do it from the palm of your hand. Imagine resetting a user's password from your smartphone, killing a process. It's slowing down a critical machine while you're out in the park with the kids. You don't need to imagine. Pulseway is the answer. It lets you monitor, manage, and control Windows, Linux, and Mac systems, all three, from anywhere, using any device, including your smartphone. You can monitor everything. You'll see real-time status, system resources, logged in users. I want to use this just for myself, for my little corner of the world. View network performance, Windows updates, stop them in their tracks, as you may want to do. IIS, SQL Server, Exchange, Active Directory, you can monitor virtual machines from VMware and Hyper-V machines, any SNMP-enabled device, of course, and a lot more. You'll always be in control. You can react to issues right away. You could fix problems while you're having a hoagie down the road. You can run commands in Terminal. Yes, on your iPhone, manage running processes. You can restart services. You can apply critical updates. You can restart systems. Fire up that Android phone. Boom. Restart those systems. Everything can be automated because you can deploy custom scripts, write your own, to automate all your IT tasks. That's when you know you're a sysadmin with a capital S and a capital A. When you're writing your own script, anything that takes more than a minute, write a script. Increase your overall efficiency. Automate anything from backups to security checks on schedule or on demand at any time from a device wherever you are. With patch management, you can scan, install, and update all your systems on the go. You can do it on demand. You can schedule it to be executed on a specific date. There's so much you can do. I can't even hit all the highlights here. Connect to a computer as if you're sitting right in front of it without opening any ports or creating any firewall rules with their secure remote desktop control. Did I say secure? Yes, secure. Real-time remote monitoring and management software. It is the expert's choice. It is awesome. You can switch between screens. You could actually have multiple on your tablet, have multiple screens open, send keystrokes, control the mouse. You don't have to go to the machine. If you want to know more? I bet you do. Pulseway.com, P-U-L-S-E, Pulseway, W-A-Y, .com/twit. Thousands of organizations and sysadmins are making their IT environments more secure, more efficient. It can do everything, and it's free for 14 days, so try it right now. Pulseway.com/twit. Everything's in here. It's actually mind-boggling. Pulseway, R-M-M. Check it out for remote monitoring and management. Pulseway, I-M-M. Just R-M-M. Just amazing. IT management software as it should be. And we thank Pulseway so much. I feel like what happened with Pulseway is they just said, everybody ought to know about this. How can we tell everybody? What do we all listen to? Security Now? Let's put it on Security Now. Pulseway.com/twit. Free for 2 weeks. Steve, I think, has taken a breath. His first in an hour and a half. and now he's caffeinated. And he's ready for more.
Earth to Gibson. Come in, Gibson, over.
Oh, Lord.
Teams from the Graz University of Technology, whom we have spoken of before, KU Leuven, and Cyberus Technology have been at it again. And if we ever wanted, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I mean, a perfect example of Bruce Schneier's sage observation that attacks never get weaker. They only ever get stronger. We have it here. What these guys have done quietly, although they've known for a year, none of us have, they have been sitting probably impatiently on this, is a truly significant advancement to the practicality of what was the mostly theoretical attack on speculation and micro-architectural performance boosting that we began talking about right from the start of last year. So the term micro-architecture is all throughout this. So let me just explain. The architecture is what the code that runs on the processor sees. So it's the registers, it's the the stack, the various execution units. You know, it's the view that the processor provides to the code. It was quite a while ago that that stopped being the only architecture in the chip, especially for the Intel chips, because the instructions are so complicated that as they kept adding new features, the idea of designing this instruction set, implementing the instruction set as gates, just as simple logic, became impossible, especially when they started wanting to get really fancy. So what happened was they created a processor inside the processor. There, you know, the so-called microcode. So that runs, the microcode runs on the microarchitecture, which is this processor running at the clock speed that is given to the chip, the, you know, 3 gigahertz or whatever it is. And that processor essentially implements the instruction set that the outside world sees. So, and that's how when Intel produces an update to the firmware of the chip, that's the microcode that implements this. And so for example, when they talk about microarchitectural data sampling vulnerabilities, what the lid that's been torn off of the Intel architecture, unfortunately, is that there are all kinds of, because you have a processor in a processor, because there's a whole nother dance going on separate from the one that's public. All of the attention up until now has been on the security of the public processor. That is, it's been scrutinized and it's been looked at and it's been validated as secure. Nothing leaks at that level. But as soon as we started looking past that, we got the Spectre and Meltdown problems at the beginning of last year. So this is just, you know, this is so tasty for researchers. No one who's really into this has been able to put it down. And what came to light last Tuesday morning, as this podcast was already set up and ready to go, was essentially, I would say, it's more than the next shoe to drop. It's an anvil dropped, because what happened was the change from theoretical to absolutely proven. This is probably why Intel was really in a panic. The Intel has known of this for a year. And so the good news is, you know, they've taken responsibility. I would do anything to be a fly on the wall to know really what has been going on inside their meetings, because, I mean, it has to be some, you know, serious discussion about, you know, how they got into this position and how these problems occurred. But anyway, what we have now, after more than a year of trouble, is the so-called, it's sort of been generalized to microarchitectural data sampling vulnerabilities. And to that original work, which first brought us Meltdown, we have on this site, cpu.fail, has zombie load that we had fun just saying last week. We have something called RIDL, fallout, and store to leak forwarding. Each of those is a different exploitation of subtle features of Intel processors, which have been produced over the last 8 years since around 2011, which as a consequence, make it extremely difficult for it, the processor, to keep its secrets as it was always designed to. That is, I mean, until the beginning of last year, we had these processors sitting on servers in cloud environments with VMs sharing a single core among any random set of parties, whether friendly to each other or not. That all changed at the beginning of last year because it turns out that it was theoretically possible. A couple examples were shown. Mostly it was done like, here's a problem. We need to fix this before it's too late. Well, what we got just last Tuesday in the form of firmware updates for the micro architectures at some significant performance hit. I've seen some benchmarks that look like it takes maybe 10 to 12% off the top, which is a chunk of performance. Because unfortunately, as we've seen, in order to, these problems are a result of the past of other threads of execution leaving trails, leaving hints in the microarchitecture, which clever researchers are able to tease out over time. And again, these attacks have only gotten better. Okay, so zombie load. I'm not going to go into infinite detail, but I just want to give our listeners a sense for this. Zombie load resurrects private browsing history and other sensitive data. It allows the leakage of information from other applications, from the operating system, across virtual machine boundaries in the cloud, and from trusted execution environments. The RIDL attack allows the leakage of information across various security domains from different buffers, such as line fill buffers and load ports. Those are microarchitecture attributes that are not surfaced at the processor level, but they're all part of the plumbing that's going on behind the scenes. RIDL demonstrates attacks on other applications, the operating system, virtual machines, and trusted execution environments. So there's a lot of overlap between these, but they are they're different types of attacks against different facets of the microarchitecture. The fallout attack allows reading what the operating system recently wrote and figuring out the memory position of components of the operating system, thus strengthening other attacks. In other words, it helps to defeat KASLR, kernel address space layout randomization. And finally, the store-to-leak forwarding exploits CPU optimizations introduced by another microarchitectural component, the store buffer, to also break address randomization, monitor the operating system, or to leak data when combined with some aspects of Spectre. Spectre created these gadgets, which were little pieces of code which were used. Store to leak forwarding is able to reuse some of these Spectre gadgets, essentially making the attacks stronger. Microsoft, for their part, last Tuesday on May 14th, wrote, on May 14th, Intel published information about a new subclass of speculative execution side channel vulnerabilities known as microarchitectural data sampling. And of course, now we know the data being sampled is somebody else's data. If you happen to be sharing an Intel processor with somebody else, Microsoft said an attacker who successfully exploited these vulnerabilities may be able to read privileged data across trust boundaries. In shared resource environments, such as exists in some cloud services configurations, these vulnerabilities could allow one virtual machine to improperly access information from another. So this is, you know, sounds like a repeat of what we've been talking about all of last year. In non-browsing scenarios on standalone systems, an attacker would need prior access to the system or an ability to run a specially crafted application on the target system to leverage these vulnerabilities. What they didn't explicitly say is that code running in a browser is able to determine what the browser has been doing. So it's a potentially significant privacy violation just using a browser at the browser level. So they allocated, or I should say the CVE system allocated four different CVEs, a microarchitecture store buffer data sampling, which was given the acronym MSBDS, microarchitecture fill buffer data sampling, MFBDS, microarchitecture load port data sampling, MLPDS, and microarchitectural data sampling of uncacheable memory, MDSUM. So over on the CPU.fail site, they did a little Q&A to sort of help demystify this. They asked, am I affected by this bug? The answer, most certainly yes. Are these software bugs? No. These bugs are in the processor. Software can work around these bugs, which costs performance. Future processors will have integrated fixes. And that is no doubt true. They ask, can I detect whether someone has exploited this leakage against me? They say, we have no data on this. The exploitation may not leave any traces in traditional log files. Can my AV detect or block these attacks? They said, while possible in theory, this is unlikely in practice. These attacks are hard to distinguish from regular benign applications. However, they write, your AV may detect malware which uses the attacks by comparing binaries after they become known. They ask, has this been used in the wild? And they answer, we don't know. So they wrote a 16-page detailed paper that I'm not going to drag us through. And I've already pretty much explained what I had here in the that I quoted from the abstract at the top of the paper. They conclude, though, saying, with Zombie Load, we showed, and this is in these 16 pages, in Zombie Load, we showed a novel meltdown type attack targeting the processor's fill buffer logic. Zombie Load enables an attacker to leak recently loaded values used by the current or sibling logical CPU. We show that Zombie Load allows leaking across user space processes, CPU protection rings, virtual machines, and SGX enclaves. We demonstrated, and they did this, the immense attack potential. And that's what has changed. The takeaway here is this went from being, well, okay, you know, yeah, in theory this could happen. This research changed this to making these practical attacks. They said, we demonstrate the immense attack potential by monitoring browser behavior, extracting AES encryption keys, establishing cross-VM covert channels, and recovering SGX sealing keys, Intel's secure enclave. Finally, we conclude that disabling hyper-threading is the only possible workaround to mitigate Zombie Load on current processors. So for what it means to us, as I said, this is primarily a further collapse in inter-thread isolation. Inter-thread isolation only matters if you've got if one way or another a system has a malicious thread running on it. In the case of a user's machine, a malicious thread we would call malware. In that case, you've already got malware on your system, and so you're in trouble. This could be a way for malware to extract encryption keys from your system. Like, for example, if you are using BitLocker, and depending upon BitLocker's encryption of your hard drive, it would be possible for malware to reach into the kernel to get the key that it would not otherwise have access to, because it would be well protected, and then, make off with it or send it somewhere, use it, do whatever it wants to. So, but in general, once you've already got a malicious thread on your system, you're already in trouble. The real problem, as I've mentioned, is in the cloud environment, where you might very well have a huge heterogeneous environment with a data center full of servers that are just mixing and matching and running anybody's code on any piece of hardware, moving VMs about without any concern. That's the way a lot of these systems are set up now. The problem is a bad guy gets in there on a system that has not been mitigated against this set of problems, and you've got trouble. I know under Linux, with these patches applied and a state-of-the-art Linux, I've seen some benchmarks that look like it takes about, as I said, about 10 to 12% of performance. Wow. Right off the top. It looks like it's a larger hit on the later processors, because the later processors more thoroughly take advantage of sophisticated microarchitecture in order to speed things up. So, as I said, my subtitle was "Speeding Up is Hard to Do." Basically, I mean, I don't know what Intel is going to do. They're probably, what it means is that we're going to have to build into our operating system some explicit flushing or maybe an additional level of blinding between threads. Right now, there is very little thread isolation between hyperthreads, because hyperthreading is basically a second set of registers that you do a very fast context switch from one bank of registers to the next. It was a clever, very inexpensive way of allowing a processor to continue running when it would otherwise have had its thread stall waiting for something. Intel said, hey, wait a minute, with almost no additional logic, we can create a lightweight context switch just by, creating a second logical thread on the same hardware. Yes, they were right, but boy, you don't want to have that other thread sharing the same core, which is what happens. You don't want to have it be malicious. So already we have this notion at the architecture level of context switching. That's that's what we do, is when we push all of the threads on the stack and then load the all the registers from a different thread that has been stopped, that's a context switch. What I think we're going to end up seeing is Intel having to, in order to save the fundamental design of their chips and implement a system which is secure, we're going to have to get something like a context switching mechanism at the microarchitecture level. It should have always had it. Nobody was looking, and nobody was this clever about, and I guess really appreciated, how much information could be obtained from little subtle variations in timing. At this point, it really breaks the barrier between hyper-threaded, a pair of threads running on the same core. And of course, as we know now, since cores share caches and we're able to probe cache contents, nothing is safe. So at a cost of performance today, we're getting firmware updates. Microsoft has said they're only going to be doing it for Windows 10. So if you are running Windows 7 in an environment where you're at risk, and again, there's a bunch of caveats, in an environment where you're at risk, then it's worth updating your BIOS. I mean, I guess in general, there's no reason not to update your BIOS as one is available from your manufacturer. But unless you are in an environment where you really are running threads that have a probability, a likelihood, a reasonable possibility of being malicious, if that's not your environment, all of this is interesting and it's being fixed for you, but probably not a source of, it should not be a source of great concern.
Good.
Yes.
And I wonder when they fix it with hardware mitigations, if they can do it without penalty.
I think we're going to get performance back. Yes. Okay. Because I mean, this really did catch them off guard. And right. I mean, as I've said before, I'm amazed they can fix this with firmware changes. I mean, that suggests that the chips are way more programmable than I would have imagined. And so the fact that they can actually add, you know, like what amounts to major features, basically there are feature registers that only the kernel has access to. Sometimes you only have like access at the BIOS level at boot time, and then it's all locked down. But they're adding bits that were never assigned to feature registers, which are controlling significant aspects of the microarchitecture. I'm amazed that they can do that in microcode. I mean, it's like the whole thing really is deeply programmable, which surprises me.
Well, so, but I mean, all they're doing is saying don't do speculative execution, in effect, right?
Yeah, but they never had a reason not to.
Right.
So why let it switch there?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, I mean, what it tells you is that a lot of the way processors work is not in the processor. It's in the microcode, which is programmable.
Right. Right.
So, I mean, this is a very stupid way of looking at it, but maybe they just did a branch around the speculative part. Like there's a chunk of code that says, well, let's see if we can figure out ahead of time what he's going to do. Just jump over that stuff. Keep on going. Don't try. Don't attempt it. And the reason I ask if hardware fixes can still give you the performance is, I imagine they're just going to eliminate speculative execution in the hardware, which would give you a hit unless they come up with something other than that.
Well, all they have, okay, knowing what they know now, they could segment the history.
We've talked about this before, because the problem is a leak of information from one thread to another. If you don't make that possible, you hide it, then you don't have to worry about it.
If the context switching goes deeper into the architecture than just at the architecture level, if the context switching is pushed into the microarchitecture, then at a cost of significantly more complexity, you get performance and you get inter-thread isolation. And that's what we need.
Right. Really interesting stuff, as always, Steve. Thank you. I wanted to say hi to you from a guy named Aaron Miller. He's a college kid at the Buckeye Career Center in Philly.
Cool.
Big listener of the show. And he and his buddies just won second place in the National BPA Awards. It's a business. The BPA is Business Professionals of America. And they have a network design competition. And there they are that's Aaron on the far right.
Very, very
cool. So he says, I owe it to Steve and Security Now. But the other thing, which I loved, is his network design included canaries.
So very nice.
Not only does he listen to you, he listens to our ads. So Aaron wanted to say hi. He and his family, David and Sharon and Aaron, were all visiting Philadelphia, Ohio, by the way.
Shout out to
there's a Buckeye Career Center in Philadelphia, PA. It's Philadelphia, Ohio. Ohio. I want to get that right. Thank you, Steve. We see people all the time who say hi to Steve. Tell Steve I owe it all to Steve. A lot of people who are in IT say, yeah, I listen to Steve. In fact, I met a guy, you'll love this, on Sunday. No names. He's in the Air Force. He is at Stanford right now studying security. He is going back to work in North Carolina at Fort Bragg where he'll be responsible for securing our nation's infrastructure against election fraud and other influence from national, other nations. And he says, and I listen to Steve religiously. I said, wait a minute, you're operating at this high a level? And he said, yeah, and I still learn a ton of stuff from Steve. So that's pretty high praise, Steve. I want to pass that
very
on.
Nice. Very cool.
Hey, we are done with security now. You can go to the website, Steve's website, grc.com, and get yourself a copy. He has regular 64 kilobit MP3s, but also 16 kilobit MP3s. They don't sound perfect, but they have the advantage of being teensy weensy. But the smallest version of this show you can get from him is the handwritten, human-written transcript from Elaine Ferris, who writes a very nice transcript of the whole show. So you can read that. Best solution is to read while you listen and use your underliner and notes. And then maybe you can win second place in the BPA Nationals. Steve also has lots of other things at grc.com, his website, including, of course, his bread and butter, SpinRite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility, and lots of information about other things, including Squirrel, soon to be a major motion picture or something. He's been writing it for years. We are at twit.tv/SN. We have video there. And, of course, your best thing to do is subscribe to in your favorite podcast program. That way you'll get a copy of it the minute it's available every Tuesday afternoon. Quick reminder, we record Tuesdays, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. You can tune in and listen or watch live at twit.tv/live. If you do that, hang in the chat room. Nice people who are all listening at the same time, so you can kind of have a conversation about what we're talking about amongst yourselves. I'm in there too. irc.twit.tv. Steve, thanks so much. We'll see you next time on Security Now.
Thank you, my friend. Till next week.
Security Now.